Remakers Mark Special Episode 26, In Memoriam 2020. Hello everyone, welcome back to Remakers Mark. Here we are in our 26th special episode where we are going to be revisiting those who we lost in the year 2020. With me, as always, are my friends, and in fact, I'm actually going to hand it off to one of those friends, and he's going to take this over, as has been tradition. Andy, our harbinger of death, but in a loving way, just somehow happens to find out that people died. Like, I don't know if he's got just the right RSS feeds or New York Times hashtags or whatever, but he seems to always know, so this is
or
his...
Or he is the Grim Reaper.
Or he is the Grim Reaper, so this is his jam.
Either way, it's a gift.
Not in a creepy way. Yes, exactly. So... Andy is going to be hosting this episode. So, Andy, I'm going to hand it off to you, mostly just so that you can go last when you're talking about the question that we're going to inevitably answer here very shortly.
You meddling kids.
Welcome, everyone, to our annual In Memoriam episode. I am Andy, the Harbinger of Death. Thank you for joining us. I get to do the fun part of introducing everybody and asking them a question. We'll start with Jeremy Nelson. Jeremy, how are you? And... what is one thing that you are looking forward to doing in 2021?
I am doing quite well. And I actually, as of 2021, I started to do, I got for Christmas a yearly journal that is about sort of achieving your goals for the year. And one of the first steps of that is to write down sort of your main five goals for the upcoming year. And one of them was to travel out of state at least five times and out of the country at least once.
Ooh, nice. Do you have destinations in mind?
Well, Michigan is going to be hopefully on that list.
Yeah.
To see you fine folks.
That'd be fantastic.
Fantastic. And next week I will be doing the first of those trips as my fiance and I are traveling to a destination that she is yet unknown to.
She hasn't told you yet? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, I haven't told her yet.
I was like, Does one of you know where it is?
I know where it is.
Okay. You're not like taking one of those old, like the clubs and putting it in your steering wheel and then just going? Like it's not that kind of, that's a bad idea.
Our destination is a lake.
Just going to put it on cruise control and see what happens.
Somewhere in Richfield.
I know they have those things where you can... you just buy a flight, but you don't know where it's going. Like those mystery flights that you can buy. I know that's a thing.
Is that also one where you wake up in a bathtub with full of ice saying, call 911, we have your kidneys?
With a incision stitched up around your midsection.
Maybe don't do that one.
Not that. No.
Okay.
No. Our first destination, I'm not going to say where it is, but it rhymes with Schmalerado.
Ooh. When are you leaving for this? I'll make sure not to publish it before.
Saturday.
Okay, oh, we'll be fine.
Have fun in Kentucky. We're going to go alphabetical. So Kyle, you are next. Kyle,
hey.
Dillahunt, how are you? And what is one thing you're looking forward to doing in 2021?
I am well, thank you very much. And I think, you know, I have the usual suspects such as hanging out with family. You know, I haven't seen my mom in a while and being able to hang out with the family around here as well. So that's a big thing. I was telling everybody here that I just bought an exercise bike. Of course, I'm on the tail end of the COVID exercise fad. But alas, things are fitting tighter than I would like them to. And I just need to. I'm really bad at editing my food habits. I can do things like, you know, I've done a month where I don't have desserts and I've done a month where like I don't have any beer or things like that. Like I can do like one thing, but if it starts to be like completely rehabbing how I eat, I am terrible at that. I like fold like Superman on laundry day. I just have the world's worst willpower for that stuff. And so I know that like food, it can be something that I can change in small ways, but I really need to know. I know that I really need to like exercise more. So that's going to be my thing, is to really like be, you know, busting it. And I like, I'm excited about nerding out about it, right? Like there's Apple Fitness Plus that we get for free at work, which is, you know, kind of like Peloton, that kind of thing. So there's like a data part of it to that. So there's, you know, things that will keep me intrigued when I'm pissed off and unhappy about being sweaty. And I think that will be good. So I'm excited about that.
I'm sweaty and I don't like it.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well,
our fitness center opened here in our building and we have been making it a point to get down there much more often. They have a rowing machine, so I can close my eyes and envision being in a canoe.
Nice.
Lee, hardly knew him. Welcome. How are you? And what is one thing you're looking forward to doing in 2021?
I'm well, and there were so many things that I had planned in 2020 that all got canceled. Michigan trip, a concert, a stand-up comedian show, CrossFit Games, and a trip out to South Dakota all got canceled because of the pandemic. So I'm hoping to just do one of those things this year. Maybe.
May the odds be ever in your favor.
Yeah. It would be nice to take another Europe trip, but I don't know if that's in the cards because I tend to plan those things many months in advance, and I just don't know if I'm going to have time to do that this year. But if not this year, next year.
I have faith in you, Lee, that you can pull it off, whatever you end up doing.
Yeah.
All right. Mark Jostig.
You just don't want to be stressed about a trip. You know, like traveling can be hard enough on its own. You want it to be a fun thing, not be like, oh God, like, and it can absolutely be that way. So yeah. I hear you there.
I said, Mark Jostig, how are you? And what is one thing you're looking forward to doing in 2021?
I'm great. Thank you. And I'm looking forward to truly appreciating the time that I spend with my family. something that I haven't done enough of since constantly being with my family over this pandemic.
Yeah.
But I'm working on it with my family and my therapist. So
you have all the pieces in place, Mark, and I appreciate you saying that out loud because I think a lot of people share in that. So that's really great.
Well, you just shared with us before we started recording one, I think, really big breakthrough development with your family.
Yes, that's true. That's that my 7-year-old daughter now enjoys playing board games, which is something very personal to me.
Huzzah!
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 Indeed.
All right. I am Andy Wicks, again, the Harbinger of Death. I am well. Thank you for asking. Gosh, so many things to look forward to potentially in 2021. Short term, I'm going to get the vaccine pretty soon. I live in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is Beer City, USA, and I would really love to go out to a brew pub a lot. I really hope that we are able to have our not quite annual podcast weekend at the Miller Cottage in Michigan. But on top of all that, I haven't seen my family face to face in over a year. So I really hope that we all can gather in one place and actually give each other hugs. I miss hugs. Do you guys miss hugs?
Yeah, seriously.
Holy
yes, tremendously.
Cow, do I miss hugs?
Yeah. Can we hug guys when we see each other?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
If we don't, why would we even see each other?
Can we like spoon like it's a silverware drawer?
Try to stop me.
Oh, Lee. God,
I love you. And then all of a sudden it turns to forking and.
Yep.
Well, it's a typical weekend. Normally we call, and I'm calling an audible here because, well, I'm the host, damn it. We go with a large and a small pick. I don't like those terms because I feel it's maybe a little demeaning. So we're just going to go with a first and a second pick.
All right.
So, Chair, you are first up on the list that I have in front of me.
Yeah.
And you're going to talk about someone who I think is very funny.
Indeed.
And I would like you to talk about that person who is funny.
Yes. The first person on our list of memorializations is the award-winning actor and comedian, director, screenwriter, author, Broadway showman, Carl Reiner, who passed away in June of this year. Carl Reiner is, man, what isn't he? He is kind of one of the grandfathers of sort of modern comedy. He was active in show business for 7 decades, if I remember that note right, getting his start back with Mel Brooks doing sort of comedy duo stuff and putting out records. One of the most famous is The 2,000-Year-Old Man, if any of you remember that one.
Jerry, I want to stop you real quick. Did you say 7 decades?
Yes, 7 decades. He started his career in the 50s.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you know how old he was when he died?
98.
Oh, wow. That's a good long run. Hats off to you, Carl Reiner.
And so, he got to start back with Mel Brooks. I mean, look at the friends list that this guy had throughout his career. Mel Brooks was his best friend. They got together consistently to watch movies together. In an interview just a few years ago, he talked about how they had a standing date where Mel Brooks would come over to his house, they'd have dinner, and then they'd watch a movie, and Mel Brooks would fall asleep with his mouth open. And like that's both beautiful and amazing that those two have had a working and friendship relationship since the 50s, and they still loved each other to that degree. But you look at some of the other people that he surrounded himself with: Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore, Steve Martin, Jerry Seinfeld was a huge fan of his. The number of people that he influenced in the comedy world is mind-boggling. He directed most of Steve Martin's early movies, and is one of the reasons why Steve Martin is sort of became a star. He directed the Dick Van Dyke Show and got Dick Van Dyke into the cultural lexicon.
I didn't know that.
And he was so influential as far as his comedy writing, his comedy directing, and he was just a really freaking funny guy. If you look at some of his old, go look up some of the old stuff that he did with the Steve Allen Show, with him and Mel Brooks, it is still to this day, it is insanely funny. He was just so good. He was a perfect straight man to Mel Brooks's bizarro wackiness. And
he also just seems like he was a nice guy. I have nothing to base that on, but he I can't imagine a bad thing being said about him.
Yeah, that's the other thing that point two that I wanted to bring up is that he just was from beginning to end, he just seemed like a very just a lovable goofball, and there was never a scandal about him. There was never anything else. He just was. He won. Let me pull this up. He won many awards. He won 11 Emmys, but it was the Mark Twain Award for American Humor. And if you win an award that has Mark Twain's name on it, you're probably a pretty wholesome guy. And yeah, if you just look at his list of what he has had his hands in, he is we owe so much of what comedy is to him. And I'll close by saying the very last thing that he did before his death was at the beginning of the pandemic. Ivan Reitman's son, Jason Reitman. Jason Reitman,
yep.
Decided to direct essentially a home movie version of Princess Bride,
with some of the original cast and a bunch of
everybody was in it. There were so many people involved in it, and it was essentially all of these celebrities, and it was all for charity. All these celebrities just filmed themselves on their cell phones and whatnot, and then Jason Reitman edited it all together, and it's hilarious and it's fun and it's so low tech and great, and there's so many big names in it. But the final scene of the movie is, if you remember, if you've watched Princess Bride, is Fred Savage and Columbo, his grandpa,
Peter Falk.
Fred said they finish reading the story of the Princess Bride, and Fred Savage said, "Grandpa, you know, do you think it'd be okay if you came back tomorrow and read it again?" And Peter Falk puts his hat on and says, "As you wish," and he walks out the door, and it's great. So the last scene of this remake was
Fred Savage.
Fred Savage was in it earlier as that character, but different people played the same characters. It was Rob Reiner,
that's right,
in bed as Fred Savage, and Carl Reiner, his dad in real life, as Peter Falk, as the grandpa, and Rob Reiner being the original director of Princess Bride, which is another great little touch. But Rob Reiner in bed saying, "Grandpa, do you think you could come over tomorrow and read it again?" And Carl Reiner turning and with that glint in his eye and that little half smile says, "As you wish," and he walks out. And that's the last thing he ever filmed.
Didn't he die literally like days later?
It was very soon after that. And so soon that they actually, Jason Reitman contacted Rob and said, "I don't want to put this in the movie unless you say it's okay." And Rob Reiner said, "Absolutely put it in." Like, that is, if there's nothing else that sort of showcases who he is as a person, it's that. And I recommend watching that whole thing if you can find it. But that part just is like a punch right in the heart for knowing that Carl Reiner was soon to pass away. He passed away peacefully in his home at the age of 98 in March. And man, what a life.
Well, yep. Said. Well said.
Yes.
The first thing of his I ever saw was The Jerk. And I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah. Oh, yep. Man.
Even as a 10-year-old kid, I thought it was hilarious. And
he also directed All of Me, which is a movie that we did on this podcast.
That's right.
Yep. The Jerk, The Man with Two Brains, I think, was a writer-director that he did. But anyway, that is my tribute to Carl Reiner. What a wonderful comedian and human being. And then I'll pass it on to Lee for our next pick.
It would be irresponsible of me to not talk about Eddie Van Halen.
I think it's required by law.
I think it is, yes. I think it was preordained that I would talk about Eddie Van Halen. I think all of us as guitar players can appreciate him as a musician and what he did for rock music. Possibly the most influential guitarist ever to pick up the instrument. I would say at least in the top five.
Those are bold words, but I think you can back them up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd agree.
But he was, like a lot of the greats, he had very humble beginnings. He was born in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, I believe, to a Dutch father and an Indonesian mother, and immigrated to the United States when he was seven. And he and his brother originally a guitar player, and he was a drummer, and they discovered one day that they had a talent for each other's instruments, so they just switched. And
that's nuts.
Because Alex Van Halen is a pretty incredible drummer.
Yeah, he's pretty great.
Yeah. And Alex had told a story once where he was trying to play this piece that, you know, he had been working on for weeks and he just couldn't quite get it. And then one day Eddie picked up the guitar and just played it, you know, and he had just been watching Alex try, and he kind of, his brain kind of connected the dots and he was just able to play it. So from then on, it was kind of like, you know, that's okay. Alex is the drummer and Eddie is the guitar player. But of course they went on to form Van Halen, which became one of the biggest bands in the 80s. I think the album 1984 went platinum five times over.
Whoa.
And to date is their most successful album of all time. Throughout his life, he, just being in that business, you're exposed to a lot of really dark things. And he got mixed up in drugs and alcohol, and he had struggled with that for a good portion of his career. He was sober after 2008, and also had some struggles with cancer. He had was diagnosed with tongue cancer at one point, and he had to have part of his tongue removed, and in turn had to relearn how to speak. And finally, he did come down with throat cancer, which is what I believe finally killed him. He died in October at the age of 65. And I've always kind of thought of him like kind of in a special way because we share a birthday. We're both January 26th.
Aww.
He was born in 1955, so a few months before Doc Brown invented the flux capacitor. And, it's one of my regrets that I never got to see Van Halen live. I think there were a few times when they came to either Minneapolis or St. Paul to play a show, and for whatever reason, I couldn't go. And now it sucks that I will never get to see them live, because his son, Wolfgang, did confirm that, you know, the band is done, because you can't have Van Halen without Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a even more so than the lead singer, which is an almost impossible hole to fill.
But yeah.
Having the the eponymous source of the band. Sorry, Alex. that's a tough one to fill.
Yeah. And I mean, Eddie was a big part of the songwriting as well. So it's, you know, if you were to replace him, you would completely change the band. It's not like, you know, bringing in Sammy Hagar to replace David Lee Roth. Their sound did change a little bit, but you could still tell it was Van Halen just because of Eddie's fingerprint in the music. I think, you know, the short stint with Gary Cherone, it sounded like Van Halen, but that's because of Eddie.
I always find it funny that the post David Lee Roth to Sam, or, you know, the Sammy Hagar transition, like the songwriting changes that happened with that were probably because of Eddie. Like, it was mostly him playing keys that changed. Like, you know, Hagar's voice is different, and I'm sure there's some songwriting stuff, but it was mostly that Eddie was like, I don't know, I got a synthesizer. It's like the cathode ray plan. Like, I got a synthesizer, and then our songwriting changed 1,000%. I was like, well, sorry, I got a synthesizer. What are you going to do?
Way to go, Kyle.
Sorry/ you're welcome.
I remember hearing news, like, back when David Lee Roth left the band and it was announced that Sammy Hagar would take his place, and then they were releasing 5150, that Eddie said in an interview that he was going to focus less on guitar stuff and do more synthesizer stuff. And I was like, what? You can't do that. But he made it work.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Jump is to date their only number one hit.
Yeah.
Really?
Yep.
Huh. I did see it. I think it was on Twitter. It was commemorating probably the 40th anniversary of their debut album. But Eddie Van Halen was tweeting about how he essentially recorded it with a stock Strat and a stock Marshall cab. And that was it.
Yep.
And that was, you know, created that, what became his signature sound.
Yep.
But that was pretty, I mean, it was pretty interesting how didn't need a lot of, you know, bells and whistles, just grip it and rip it.
And he was an innovator too. He's the first guitarist to ever take a humbucker and put it in the bridge position of a Strat body.
Huh.
And he was the first to ever use the technique of dipping the pickups into wax to reduce the noise.
Huh.
Didn't know that was a thing you could do.
That's so cool.
Yep. Yep.
Lee, one of my favorite Eddie Van Halen stories is, Nuno Betancourt, actually, who I know is your guy. Like, I know you're a huge Extreme fan, which is awesome. Nuno Betancourt, yeah. I think Extreme was opening up for Van Halen at some point, and Nuno walked on stage while Eddie was sound checking, and he was like, hey, do you mind if I have a go on your rig? And Eddie was like, yeah, man, go for it. And he was like, I couldn't wait to sound like Eddie Van Halen. And then he started playing, and he was like, I just sounded like me. Like, I didn't sound like Eddie Van Halen at all. Like, it's, you know, it's not the gear. It's just like, it's the fingers, it's the feel, it's the everything. Like, you know, the tone might have been a little bit different, but it was like, it was me playing. I didn't sound at all like Eddie Van Halen. I just thought that was so cool. It's like, you know, you don't ask, like, what pen Shakespeare used, you know, like there's such right, a gear fetishism in a lot of things that I just always think about that as a way of just like, listen, it's like how you play and the feel that you put into it and the energy and heart that you put into it. That is really what matters.
I imagine something similar if you went up to the Edge and was like, hey, man, can I play your guitar? I want to sound like you.
I'm going to play a D and just let it go.
Yeah. But so that's my guy, Eddie Van Halen, R.A.P.
Nicely done, Lee. Nicely done.
Thank you. Let's move on to Kyle.
Yes, indeed. I'm going to be talking about Alex Trebek. Alex, host of Jeopardy, which is like my favorite. George Alexander Trebek, turns out he was a George. Who knew? George Alexander Trebek was born in Sudbury, Ontario on July 22nd, 1940. He graduated from the University of Ottawa with a degree in philosophy in 1961, though he pretty much always knew he wanted to be a broadcaster. So, you know, he had that going for him from the beginning. He started working at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation before he graduated from college, basically doing like anything that he could. He tried to fill in, like I don't know if he just had his ears to the train tracks of CBC, but like anytime anybody called out sick, he'd be like, I could do that. And he would just jump in and do like everything. He was just absolutely hungry. He started his game show career in 1966, where he hosted a high school quiz show called Reach for the Top, which is awesome. So he was 26, showing, you know, high schoolers trivia stuff, I guess. And in maybe the most Canadian and 1970s thing possible, he was on the short list to succeed the host of Hockey Night in Canada, which, knowing Canada, is probably a pretty big show, in 1971.
Yes,
but he was not chosen for the job because they didn't want the host to have a mustache. just like, that blew my mind when I read that. And that didn't come out until after his death. The person officially, like the executive producer officially said, like, yeah, we didn't hire him because he had a mustache. Which, oh my God, amazing. So good on you, Alex. Trebek moved to the United States in 1973 and from the get-go worked on several game shows. So that was his jam all along, including The Wizard of Odds, High Rollers, Double Dare, not to be confused with a Nickelodeon show, The $128,000 Question, Battle Stars, Pitfall, Malcolm, featuring an animated co-host, and Lucky Numbers. He started hosting Jeopardy in 1984 and remained its host until his death this year. Since June 13th, 2014, he held the Guinness Book record for the most game show episodes hosted by the same presenter in the same program, for at that time having hosted 6,829 episodes of Jeopardy, overtaking previous record holder Bob Barker. So if you think about how long Bob Barker was at The Price is Right, it felt like eternity, and Trebek like blew past that. He was very philanthropic. He donated a lot to University of Ottawa. They had a Alex Trebek Forum for Dialogue. And then I believe the either Humanities or a Broadcasting Building was named in his honor. On March 6th, 2019, he announced that he was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, so very far along. On July 16th of 2020, he gave an update saying that while he still felt fatigued, the chemo was paying off, and he was looking forward to taping again. He published his book shortly thereafter. In October, he underwent surgery related to his cancer treatment. He returned to the show a couple weeks after that, but wasn't able to do his full workload. He taped his final episodes on October 29th of 2020, and then died November 8th of that year. So it all happened really quickly there at the end. It was about 18 months fighting stage 4 pancreatic cancer, which, if you know anything about stage 4 cancer, that is a beast. And I'm glad that we had that long with him. The thing that I love about Alex, the things that I love about Alex Trebek are many. One is that he was a goofball, which you got a little bit on Jeopardy from time to time. But if you ever saw him interviewed, he was a total weirdo. And I loved it. It made me so happy. Like, for this person to be so smart and so clever and so in tune and on top of things. And then you hear him interviewed and he was just a goof. That made me so happy every time I would hear him interviewed. And you would see some of that come out in Jeopardy. His dialogue back and forth with some of the contestants, just like really sweet, really funny, and like really strangely sarcastic. I found a quote from Ken Jennings that says, "He's goofier than you'd think. Between rounds, he'll take audience questions and he's cracking jokes that are self-deprecating. He swears, he does accents. I've seen him do little bits of song and dance. He's more the goofy uncle than the stern dad," which is the perfect description of him. I just absolutely love that. Like, Alex Trebek to me was the goofy uncle who also just happened to host a game show that I adore, right? And that's the other thing that I love about him is right now, I'm going to like jump gently onto a soapbox here. Right now, intellectualism is a swear word in so many ways. And I just think that is the dumbest thing ever. And so few things celebrate.
So do the anti-intellectualists.
Right. Yes, unfortunately. So like, I just think that celebrating intelligence and brilliance and achievement and talent, like to have Jeopardy be that day in, day out, basically like spits in the face of that. And I'm sure there are any intellectualists that are fans of Jeopardy, which, good Lord, I hope you see the irony, but you probably don't. But I just like, for all of the world where people aren't trusting scientists and people are saying like the elite are smart. Like, you want the elite helping with things. Yes, there are bad elites, but like, it would be like, I don't want superheroes. I want normal heroes. It's like, well, I don't know that you do, friend. So I just love that.
I want Alex Trebek.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, that's right on. So I just love that he championed brilliance and intelligence and celebrated that. And that's something that I love. Like, I love when I sit down to Jeopardy, I'm not doing it to like be like, haha, look how smart I am. It's to be like, wow, look at all the things I don't know and I wish I did. And I learned two things today. Or, oh my gosh, how amazing is it that this person knows all of that? It's just incredible. I really celebrate him for what he did for intellectualism. It's, which seems like such a strange thing, but I just like, I'm a huge fan of him. In addition to Jeopardy, he was also a guest star on my favorite X-Files episode, where he played one of the two men in black who is like a agent charged with the supervision of extraterrestrial people on Earth, hiding their really? Existence from other humans. The other man in black, Jesse Ventura, thank you very much, from the episode Jose Chung's from Outer Space. That is like, if you do anything after all this,
please find a clip of this.
Go find that episode. I'll see if I can find the clip. But my God, that whole episode is absolutely bonkers. Absolutely bonkers.
What season is that?
I don't know. 1996. So probably, season three. Here we go. Season three.
Oh,
it is so weird. That. It's like if David Lynch directed an X-Files episode. It is just so out there bonkers. Absolutely love it. Anyways, he was a goofball. I loved it. I just wanted to mention the X-Files thing because you just have to see that. But I am just like so thankful for Alex Trebek and what he did. Like, he just made me so happy. And like, when he died, I just texted Kate. I was like, my heart hurts, you know, like I'm missing a friend. And he was a TV friend, but it didn't make him any less of a friend because I was so happy to join him anytime that I could on the show. And I have Jeopardy on my calendar every day, 4:30 to 5:00, on Monday through Friday. I have Jeopardy on my calendar. So if I can watch it, you're damn right I do. So, Alex, thank you for being smart, being wonderful, being funny, being weird as hell and goofy, and for showing people that being smart is a beautiful thing.
Kyle, that was wonderfully said. Do you ever watch episodes, seasons of Jeopardy? I think they're on Netflix.
Yeah, we do sometimes. Like, if we don't get to watch the kind of 4:30 one, sometimes we'll watch a couple of them on Netflix or Hulu or something like that. Yeah. It was really fun. Shortly after he died, they showed like the first, like, episodes from the first year, the first 5 years, the first 10 years, like kind of showing the path of the show. And we watched the second episode ever. And it was just amazing to see sort of from whence it came, both from a style of the game show, the style of the host, the style of the set. Like, it was amazing. It was really cool.
Was he the first host, or was there another host before him?
There was another host before him. It was a gentleman whose name I don't recall, and then it stopped for a bit, and then he picked it up and then held it since 84.
Gotcha. I work in a facility that is – part of it is an adult foster care facility, and Jeopardy is often playing in the background when I'm there working with the people that live there. And I will tell you, nothing makes my day more readily than if I get like – two or three answers in a row on Jeopardy.
Right.
Like, I will feel like I am the smartest son of a bitch in the world. And it will, I will ride that way for at least 24 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not like you get that in like the Van Halen category, right? Like, that would have like, okay, I'm going to get 4 out of 5 in that. But it's like the, I don't know, Roman history or something where I'm like, oh, nothing. I'm going to get nothing. And then if I get 2, I'm like, I am the king of the world.
And if it's a clue where Alex Trebek has to read a term in a foreign language, I don't know what we're talking about here, and I still get it, I'm like, that's right. I got that one.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I'm going to bet it all.
Yep.
And then I'll miss the one that's like, he was the first president of the United States.
So. Did he ever make an appearance on Saturday Night Live when they were doing the Jeopardy thing?
I think he did.
Yes, he did.
Did he?
Yeah, I think so. Yep.
God, I miss that.
it wasn't overly funny or anything. He just basically kind of showed up and sort of patted Will Ferrell on the back and said, okay, it's time to be done now.
He was stern dad in that moment.
And then he shut down Sean Connery in some form. But yeah, it was just kind of the end of the sketch. He came out and applause. And then he, you know, said a couple of things, but it wasn't overly goofy or anything.
Okay.
He acknowledged
I got to find that.
Oh man, we got a lot of links to submit here for this one.
Heck yeah. Andy, tell us about your pick, please. I can't wait to hear.
Yeah, wow. Well, I think you should have gone last, Kyle, because I am talking about Fred Willard. Not that Fred Willard wasn't someone who was worthy of you Googleizing, but I don't have quite the emotional attachment to him that Kyle had to Alex. But that's okay. That's okay. Frederick Charles Willard Jr. was born in 1933, passed away last year, was an American actor. If you don't know the name Fred Willard, you will most certainly recognize him if you looked him up and or saw any number of Christopher Guest mockumentaries or the Rob Reiner, again, film This is Spinal Tap. Where really he played oftentimes some various iteration of the same character, that being kind of the bumbling fool who's a bit of a son of a bitch. But he was very, very good at that role. I was looking at his Wikipedia page, and just the list of acting credits is incredibly lengthy, but it's all these little... He guest starred here. He had a slight recurring role there, this and that and the other. He actually didn't have a ton of really big roles. He had a plethora of small roles, but the ones that he's almost definitely more well known for are the roles such as in Waiting for Guffman, when he plays he and his Catherine O'Hara. They are a husband and wife team who are travel agents who have also never left the state, but who also love doing amateur theater. In Best in Show, he plays the announcer for the dog show, who really, I have to think, I mean, in any Christopher Guest movie, there isn't a lot of scripting done, but really for him, I wonder if they just had him show up and was like, Fred, have fun with this one. Just be the opposite of what the other guy is doing. And the other guy is this very proper British announcer, and he is the crass American. I think Fred Willard was someone who never failed to make me laugh. His style of humor is kind of like catnip to me, and that's okay. It was very much, I think, the anti-humor for a lot of other people that are close to me, and that's okay too. But I got a good laugh out of it. Out of many, many things that he did. I'm not going to go on for a very long time, but I recommend, if you are not familiar with Mr. Willard's work, that you look up. I will recommend Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show specifically to go read or go view those movies for your consideration.
Two things. I love improvisational comedians that in movies, Jonathan Winters, Fred Willard, Robin Williams, they're just... When they do that type of skill well, it just hits me in the absolute right way. Mm-hmm. And I saw two quotes from interviews, and the first one was I don't remember who he was having the interview with. It might have been Letterman or somebody, but it was very early on, shortly after Waiting for Guffman, and he said, as he was talking about auditioning for roles and getting parts and things, and he said, everybody's got that little trap door in their head that they open up and they'll look inside and they'll think, oh, if I let that out, I'll look foolish. I just leave that door open all the time. So I just think that perfectly sums him up as a person. And then the second story is from A Mighty Wind, another Christopher Guest movie.
Oh, man.
And there's a scene in there where I think it's the... Oh man, I don't remember which band it is. It might be the Folksmen are practicing or warming up or something. And Fred Willard, who plays an agent, in the movie. Just this dopey, permed Hawaiian shirt guy that has a story for everything. He walks up to him and he tells him this big long story about how he's got an idea for a song for him based on Moby Dick, and who's got this famous expression, "Thar she blows," and then the water would fall down on everybody, even the ladies, he says. And then at the end of it, they'd all tip their guitars over and the water would pour out and it'd be funny and this big gag. It's hilarious. In the interview, Christopher Guest said, "The only note I gave him was, band is rehearsing, you interrupt them." And that was it.
That was, yeah, he was the agent for the new Main Street Singers.
Oh, God,
but
that's good.
Watch that clip and then watch it knowing that all he was told was, go interrupt them. And it just makes it 100 times better.
That brings to mind, because I was just listening to this episode, the filibuster scene in Parks and Rec, where Patton Oswalt's character is never told to stop, so he just keeps going and he keeps going and he keeps going and he keeps going. So Fred Willard, whew, man, makes me laugh even in death.
Yep.
And finally, for concluding round one, we turn to Mark. Mark, to you.
Yes. So you probably know Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa, the Black Panther, but you might also know him as Jackie Robinson, or James Brown, or Thurgood Marshall, which is to say that he was sought after. And to say that he was sought after is an understatement. In recent years, if Hollywood was producing a biopic of a black man, I would guarantee that some casting agent suggested Chadwick Boseman, probably multiple casting agents for multiple projects in the exact same moments. And for good reason. In the New York Times obituary for him, they use words like regal, gravitas, dignity, painting a picture of a man who quietly elevated Hollywood, behaving with the grace and nobility that would inspire an actual superhero. Yes, he was talented, displaying the versatility of an actor's actor, but it was his actual character in real life that was so remarkable. He was not any of the things that are so often said to denigrate many celebrities. He was not fussy or persnickety. He was not mouthy or bombastic. He was not arrogant. He was not violent. He was just a good dude, and he didn't make a big deal about it. And that is also an understatement. Chadwick Boseman was better than Hollywood, and he made Hollywood better while he was in it. He was 43, which was far too soon. Rest in peace, Chadwick Boseman. Also, Wakanda forever.
Hear, hear.
Agreed on all counts. Hollywood would be better off if there were more Chadwick Bosemans in it.
Yes, agreed.
There is a clip of Chadwick Boseman, I believe, presenting is it a Lifetime Achievement Award to Denzel Washington? I'll have to find out something. But the speech that he gives is really, really profound, talking about the influence that Denzel Washington had on all of these black actors that came after him. And it's just, it speaks to exactly what you said, Mark, about how his own presence, he was just so, I think regal is a great term. So, I think I'll see if we can find a link to that, because I think it speaks almost as well to Chadwick Boseman as it did to Denzel Washington.
Yeah. And to think that he was that graceful and that impactful all while struggling with colon cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, he was busy right up until his death.
It blows me away that he filmed all of the Black Panther stuff and more in addition to that, while having and dealing with colon cancer and while keeping that completely aside from his work.
Yeah.
Like, he did not let it affect his work in the slightest. And it was the amount of mental and physical fortitude that must have taken to do the work that he needed to do to capture these roles and fight this physical battle is just unreal, and really, to me, speaks to his character in yet another way, in another level.
Yeah. I mean, I was completely shocked at hearing about his death. I had no idea that he was even sick, and I think that was probably, I think for many of us, I mean, I'll speak for myself, but I would ask, I guess, did you guys even realize that he was sick before he died?
No.
Nope. Yeah.
I had no idea.
I think if anything that was good that came out of that, and I don't want to wish good out of someone passing away, but in the thick of COVID, there was so much politicalization of wellness and what you need to do in order to help others that I feel like it brought a little bit of a light on, like, you don't know what anybody is going through at any given moment. You know, it was a very heated time and continues to be, but certainly was really in the thick of it where, you know, everybody was against each other for masks. Like it was not a health thing. It was a politics thing. And it's like, I think that it added the opportunity for empathy to be introduced into that equation more so than, you know, any scientist could, any friend could, any conversation could. Just the fact that, you know, he did all of that while suffering and you didn't know it, you know, for whatever reason, he didn't tell people. And that's his choice, you know, like he made that choice and that is absolutely him to own. But just to build that empathy of like, wow, I didn't know he was going through that, which is, you know, something that we talk about a lot in our family and at work. And something I'm proud of is like, you know, you don't know where people have been that day, that month, that year. And so, you know, treat people with empathy and kindness as best you can.
I think similar mm-hmm. sentiments occurred when Anthony Bourdain died.
Yeah.
And even more so when Robin Williams died. Now, those obviously are both different circumstances, but it was similar, I think, especially with Robin Williams, because that was, I think, also a shock for a lot of people. Probably not people who were close to him, but people around him. And Robin Williams was, I think, relatively universally beloved. So to have that taken away from us was a very jarring wake-up call, and I think a kind of a reset button for a lot of things, like you said. All right, so that concludes round one. Not going to call it anything but round one.
I like it.
So we're going to move on to our second picks. I guess I'm up first, according to the Google Doc that's sitting in front of me. So here I go again on my own. I'm going to speak on Diana Rigg. Dame Enid Diana Elizabeth Rigg, born in 1938, was a British actress and I believe was a paragon of grace, class, and beauty. I first knew her as the host of Mystery on PBS when I was a kid. That was my first introduction to her. That was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And my mom liked to watch a lot of mystery shows, so I watched them too. A lot of Hercule Poirot. But of course, she was widely known before that because I was an idiot child who didn't know any better. Her theater career ran from 1957 to 2018. She was on television from 1959 to 2020, and her film credits ran from 1968 to a posthumous release that will come out later in 2021. My personal favorites are her role as Lady Holiday in The Great Muppet Caper, I believe early 1980s, and as Teresa Tracy DiVincenzo on Her Majesty's Secret Service. In my opinion, I think the best Bond girl, and ahead of its time portrayal of a woman who can hold her own in the Bond universe. Also a little trivia. So she was also very well known for playing in the British series, The Avengers. I think, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes. That's correct.
I just had a little brain fart. So she was the second actress to play the role of Mrs. Emma Peel. And when she was asked to audition, she had never seen the show, didn't really know anything about it, but went out for it. She was a young actress. And after the first series was finished, she asked for a pay raise and talked about, this was in the early 1960s, I think, want to say like 65, somewhere in that area. She asked for a pay raise and she talked about how this was well before there was any sort of balance in the gender pay issue, but she said that she had essentially no support from her male co-star, I forget his name, but who played her essentially the opposite half of the main duo and or any other women in show business at the time. No one supported her. And she developed this reputation as being kind of this mercenary who was out for money. And she was, I think, unfairly labeled as maybe difficult to work with. But really all she wanted was fair pay. She worked almost all the way up until her death and had roles. She had a recurring role in the Game of Thrones series. I think was well respected in essentially every decade in which she worked. So here's to you, Diana Rigg, RIP. Dame Diana Rigg, excuse me.
her Game of Thrones character was so good. Sorry to jump
in. Oh, no,
there,
not
but
at all.
Like, there was a moment in the last, I can't remember if it was last season or the second to last season, where she basically outs herself as someone who killed someone. And it is glorious. Like, it's, you've never wanted someone to own a murder more, which is a strange sentence to say out loud, but I'm gonna go with it. It is phenomenal. And she is so good in that series. Just a beautiful character. And she just owns it. So good.
Agreed. Very agreed.
Mm-hmm. And also the pairing of Diana Rigg and George Lazenby in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Also, I think the most handsome Bond and Bond girl couple in the filmography.
So, dang, big words.
I'm just saying, George Lazenby is a handsome man, and she was a beautiful lady. Anywho, Mark, it is to you.
Yes, for my second pick, I present for your consideration, Mr. Ian Holm. Ian Holm was a unique character in the world of acting. He was an accomplished stage actor, winning awards for his portrayals in Shakespearean drama, but he simultaneously had a long acting career on screen, running the gamut of character and genre. He could do heavy drama, as in Henry V, or dark sci-fi, as in Alien, or light sci-fi, as in The Fifth Element. And he apparently had a taste for Terry Gilliam films, acting in both Time Bandits and Brazil. Also, he was Bilbo Baggins. One might say that Ian Holm was versatile, including me. Me would say that Ian Holm was versatile. He had two long and remarkable careers at the same time and probably deserved more accolades than he got. He was 11 years old and will be missed.
Well done. Well done.
That's a good long life.
Yeah, the fact that he could play, because he was in that Jack the Ripper movie, right? As the
From Hell? That one?
From Hell.
Was he in that?
He was in From Hell, and he was the bad guy in that. And then he's Bilbo Baggins, and then he, like, for having a career as long as he did, he didn't end up in the Alan Rickman school of, like, you're gonna play this type of, like, Alan Rickman's a fantastic actor, but he kind of got typecast into playing types of roles in different ways. And Ian Holm was so all over the board with his abilities.
Totally was.
He was also the replicant or android in the first Alien.
Yeah. He was so good in that.
Yep.
Yeah, he was so good.
Way better than Fassbender.
Yeah. Normally that's blasphemy, but here I'll agree with you, yes.
Yeah. I think Fassbender would even agree with that.
Yeah.
Hey, Jared, let's move on to you.
Yeah, for my second pick, I'm going to go a little bit in a different direction here, and I'm going to talk about Luis Troiano. I can't speak for all of us here at the podcast, but I'm confident that there are a number of us who are fans of the Great British Baking Show and its various iterations.
Amen. Mm-hmm. And cheers to that.
Luis Troiano was a contestant on Series 5 of that show in 2014, and he passed away in 2020 at the age of 48 from a type of cancer that I can't pronounce. Oesophageal?
Esophageal?
Andy? Esophageal?
It's the British spelling of esophageal cancer.
Ah.
Okay. That's what it is. And I just wanted to talk about him because, number one, he is a sweet, sweet man, as you can see from that series of the show and watching him compete. But also in a larger sense, I just want to talk about the Great British Baking Show and just how much wholesomeness that it has brought to television and to reality television. And he is a very wonderful example of that. In his series, there was controversy in one episode, not with him, but with other contestants. And the controversy basically amounted to one baker taking something out of a freezer to move it slightly to put her stuff in.
It was a tense episode.
and the ice cream didn't set because the way that it was edited and cut, it appeared that though she took the other person's out and left it out, when in actuality it was out for maybe 10 seconds just to, like, move things around so that they could both fit in there. the contestant whose ice cream didn't set, he ended up just throwing it in the trash. And then because he didn't have something to present, they had to send him home, even though he probably wouldn't have gotten sent home, and so on and so forth. And so there was a big outcry on Twitter, but then everybody came out and said, no, no, no. It was just how it was edited. There wasn't any problems. Everybody's great. And the British sensibility of the Great British Baking Show, its hosts, its contestants, the way that it's written, the way that it's filmed and edited, it brings such a wonderful camaraderie and fellowship and wholesomeness to television that I can't wait to watch new seasons as they come out. Luis was one of the finalists. He was in the top three of his year, and he ended up not winning, but watching his journey was great. Afterwards, he wrote a cookbook, and he was on other BBC food shows. His family said after his passing that that show changed his life and brought him into this new world of sort of British celebrity, which is not the same as U.S. celebrity.
It's better.
But he seemed to just love life, and he made the most of the things that he was given, and I appreciate that about him without demanding more, just being able to stay humble and to celebrate that, you know, he got his little moment of fame. He did what he could with it. His cookbook, by the way, is called Bake It Great. And that's just is perfect. So Luis Troiano and in a larger sense, the Great British Baking Show as a whole, is to be celebrated, and, is very much just a wonderful man and a wonderful show.
I had no idea that's who that was. I didn't know that he died. This is the first that I heard about that. I meant to look your name up because I didn't recognize it and I didn't get to. Wow. I had no idea.
He didn't die that long ago either.
Yeah, November 8th, I think it was. Something like that.
Yeah, it was in November and he was only 48.
I had no idea. He was a sweet man. Absolutely.
This is by far our most heartwarming, like, in memoriam episode. You know?
Honestly, I attributed that to where we are right now, getting out of this year, and just like everything is just so much more on the surface and so much more valuable.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
True.
It's funny when we were in the pre-production. Or when we were kind of getting ready for this one, nobody could really think of people that died. We're like, I don't feel like a lot of people died. And then, of course, we pull up the New York Times thing, and there was like, we're like, them, her, who? Like, there was so many, which, you know, again, a reflection of where we're at as a world right now, where everything is big. And, you know, I think it's okay that some of those got kind of pushed out of our brain. But, you know, again, I'm very happy to be heartwarmingly celebrating them. Yes.
We all just need like a big... Not only do we need a big group hug and spooning session, like we just need a big ugly cry that results in like hysterical laughing, you know,
with just with a chaser of arts funding.
I think that's the definition of hysteria.
Yeah, there you go. Kyle, let's move on to you.
You got it. So I'm going to be talking about Sir Alan Parker, who is a film director. He was born in February of 1944. The reason why I chose him is sort of twofold. One, I find sort of chameleonic directors fascinating, people that can make so many different types of movies. Like if someone says, let me rewind just a little bit. If someone says a Tarantino movie, you know what the feel of it is going to be as a whole. Not 100%, but you kind of know what you're getting into. Similar with a lot of Scorsese's work, though he can be diverse as well. I think of something like Kundun, where it is so not anything like Mean Streets or Taxi Driver in New York or whatever. But I like directors like Stanley Kubrick, P.T. Anderson, Steven Soderbergh, Ang Lee, Danny Boyle, where, you know, if someone says an Ang Lee movie, it can be one of 25 different things. And I love that. I love that about directors like that. And Alan Parker was very much one of those directors. He has a pretty lengthy resume. He was a little bit of a genre filmmaker, but he bounced between lots of genres. So in a way where, you know, he chose to make genre films, but he was not a genre filmmaker, if you will. So he made some musicals, Bugsy Malone, Fame, The Commitments, and Evita. Some kind of true life dramas, Midnight Express, Mississippi Burning, Angela's Ashes, a couple thrillers, Angel Heart, The Life of David Gale. So, you know, a very competent filmmaker who kept growing throughout his career and kept making interesting choices with his movies in a way where if someone said there's an Alan Parker movie coming, I'd be like, okay, I want to check that out just because it's him, because I know it will be something that interests me. It might not be my favorite movie ever. It might not be something that like blows my mind, but I know it's going to be a well-crafted, great movie. And I feel like that is few and far between. You know, there's so much inconsistency that to have somebody that can do that is a beautiful thing. So that's one reason why I like him. And I chose to focus on him. The other thing is another musical that he directed of sorts, which is The Wall, the Pink Floyd movie, The Wall. Like many people, I saw The Wall in junior high, high school-ish. I can't remember exactly when. I saw it at a friend's house. And along with...
I was not like other people then.
What's that?
Was there a laser show?
It was not a laser show. No, this was at home. No, this was at, yeah.
Okay.
Along with like Clockwork Orange and The Crow, Natural Born Killers, like it was kind of like the darkening of my cinematic world and kind of a little bit of a counterculture piece to it, which I was in favor of, right? Like, you know, don't get me wrong.
Did you shave your eyebrows after watching that?
I did not. No, I was far too terrified to do something that bold. I was a terrified nerd in high school. Don't worry. things have really changed, let me tell you. And so, you know, like that style of movie, you know, the music to it. It was also the introduction to Pink Floyd for me, where like I think I knew they existed, but I didn't really know. But that was kind of an introduction to that, too. So, you know, I'm grateful to him for having made that movie. I feel like, you know, in the Sir Alan Parker oeuvre, it is a lesser Parker. It's not a great movie, which is fine, but it gets its point across very thoroughly, and the music's great. And it's, you know, it's like something every teenage or every kind of high schooler should see. Everybody should go through a Wall phase. So that's the two. I immediately thought of The Wall and then was reminded in researching it a little bit more why I liked him so much. So Alan Parker died July 31st of this year. So he was 76. Lee, close us up here.
Well, I'm going to be talking about the one and only Frank Costanza himself, Jerry Stiller.
I think it's a great way to close us out.
Yes.
Most people know that he is Ben Stiller's dad. I was looking at his filmography, and it's quite a long list of television, film, stage appearances. His career started in 1953 and went all the way through 2016. So, and it seemed like he never stopped working. There's every year, almost every year, he has some sort of acting credit between those years. There's always something that he's doing, whether it's just a guest spot on a TV show, just a really small part in a movie. But I know him best, of course, from Seinfeld, where he appeared in 26 episodes as Frank Costanza. And most of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld are the ones where he's a part of the story. He's very much a scene stealer, and it's just he had such a natural gift of making people laugh, just kind of being almost not really being himself, but just being the character and not trying to, I guess, overtake the scene. He was never trying to upstage anybody.
He didn't overact.
Right. And everybody who worked with him just loved working with him. Like, apparently he was one of the nicest guys ever. Even when they did a Comedy Central Friars Club roast of him, I think it was, I don't know, 2009 or something like that. the presenters all came up and they were just really making fun of each other and not really making fun of him. And whenever they did, it was very lighthearted and fun. It wasn't anything really super mean like they tend to do now, where it seems like it's just those Friars Club roasts are just a contest of who can be the most disgusting to each other, I guess. But with him, it was more good-natured ribbing, and it was kind of fun to see. I really appreciate that he was so funny on Seinfeld. Like just watching the outtakes of some of the episodes, some of the scenes that he was in, they're just hilarious. They're funnier than the episode themselves. He passed away of natural causes. One of the few on our list who died of natural causes in May of last year, and lived to the ripe old age of 92.
Nice. I think he and Fred Willard have a lot in common in that when they were doing their craft, other people who should have been peers with them stopped to watch.
Yeah. That's a good description.
Yep.
What was the duo that he was a part of? Somebody in Stiller. Can't remember. It was like a famous comedy duo.
Mira Stiller and Mira. Yes. That was his wife.
Yep. So good.
Yep.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, they were really foundational in terms of like improv style comedy, kind of getting some degree of regular attention.
Yep.
I had a hard time not laughing really, really hard while you were saying all that, but I was just thinking of the Del Boca Vista Seinfeld one where he can't say Del Boca Vista, and it's so dumb, but my God, it is so funny. Oh, Jesus, I was trying not to laugh, and I'm really trying hard now, but God, that's funny.
Or the one where they're in the police station where he's picking up George and he's arguing with Elaine. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus just cannot keep a straight face. Like, she keeps cracking up. And that's a really funny outtake scene.
I love it.
So, Jerry Stiller, R.I.P.
There you go. Right.
Indeed.
And with that, that concludes our annual In Memoriam episode of celebrities, actors, musicians, directors, creatives that we lost in 2020. Thank you for joining us. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out, mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all the people, movies, nouns, adjectives, verbs that we discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including Google Play, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, where you can rate and review Remakers Mark, which would mean the world to us. And now YouTube! We are on both Facebook, search for Math is Hard Net, or Remakers Mark, and on Twitter, at Remakers Mark, or on Instagram, at Remakers Mark Podcast. So please join in the discussion there as well. Gentlemen, thank you for celebrating life with me. Thank you for being here. Thank you for getting through 2020, and here's to 2021. Gentlemen, may the force be with you.
And also with you.